Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science as well as its impact on society. And today, leading off, once again, we're going to summarize some of the big stories in science and technology. Well, our lead story today is the headline story around the world, and that is the President of the United States has stated that the U.S. will pull out of the nuclear agreement with Iran, which was the cornerstone of the foreign policy of the previous president, President Barack Obama. And then the question is, well, why? And what are the consequences? We have a chorus of criticism coming in from Europe. Other people, however, are chuckling about the flaws within the nuclear agreement with Iran. So we're going to talk today about the pros and cons about pulling out of the nuclear deal with Iran. And what does it mean for world peace? And speaking about world peace, believe it or not, some people are saying that perhaps President Donald Trump should get the Nobel Prize in Peace for reducing tensions in the Korean Peninsula. In fact, three Koreans, U.S. citizens, have been released from North Korea in a sign of goodwill. But what will it take? What will it really take to begin the process of denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula? Not just freezing the stockpile of perhaps 20 to 60 atomic bombs that North Korea may possess, but actually denuclearizing the entire peninsula. What would it take, and what are some of the hazards? And then on the medical front, scientists were elated to announce that they have created an artificial pancreas for people who suffer from diabetes. The initial news is great. However, there are lots of caveats and lots of exceptions, but it does mean that we're slowly making progress toward one day curing one of the great problems of the 21st century, and that is the rise of diabetes, which can have horrible side effects. The amputation of your limbs, blindness, just to name a few of the possible outcomes of diabetes. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. The big story is hitting the headlines around the world, and that is that President Donald Trump has lived up to his campaign promises and has pulled the United States out of the international peace agreement to freeze the nuclear program of Iran. Many Europeans were shocked by the announcement. Many Europeans were hoping that President Donald Trump would reverse his position and maintain the nuclear deal. Other people have pointed out that even the supporters of the Iran nuclear agreement admit that there are flaws in that agreement. So let's look at the pros and cons of the situation. The people that backed the Iranian nuclear deal stated that, well, it was a tremendous accomplishment because it froze. It successfully froze the Iranian nuclear program. Realize that the Iranians have thousands of ultracentrifuges capable of enriching uranium far beyond the 3% that is found in commercial nuclear reactors, up to 90%, which is bomb-grade material. So the nuclear deal with Iran successfully froze that arsenal. Second, it turns out that regular inspections have in fact panned out, that the Iranians have allowed inspections of its nuclear facilities, which were monitored by the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency of the United Nations, and by all accounts, all the inspections were positive. And so it means that the Iranians were living up to the deal. They weren't trying to cheat. They were living up to the deal of freezing their nuclear program. And it means that trade with Iran was beginning to go back to normal. And that's what the Iranian people want. They don't want to suffer under the sanctions that were maintained by the United Nations, the European Union, and the United States. They want to live a normal life. And that's one of the other accomplishments of the treaty, that it made possible the Iranian economy gradually entering into the world economy once again. And the Europeans, of course, love that because Iran has a huge petroleum industry, and that's what the Europeans want. They want access to the oil of the Iranian peninsula. So these are all the pros in favor of the nuclear deal. But now, in all fairness, let me mention some of the flaws of the Iranian nuclear agreement. Even the backers, even the vehement backers of the Iranian nuclear agreement agree that there are some flaws that, well, have to be addressed. The first flaw is that the treaty says nothing about ballistic missiles. And sure enough, the Iranians have been regularly testing its arsenal of ballistic missiles. And around 2025, when the treaty finally expires, well, Iran will have a modern nuclear missile fleet, capable of perhaps dropping an atomic bomb on a moment's notice with very good accuracy. So some people think that it's hypocritical that on one hand, the Iranians say that they're going to freeze their nuclear stockpile, but on the other hand, there they are testing away a whole battery of ballistic missiles, some of which are actually being used in warfare. The Saudi Arabian government, an ally of the United States, has publicly stated that rebels in Yemen are firing ballistic missiles at the capital of Saudi Arabia. That, they say, is an act of war. And they say it's because of the flaws in the Iranian agreement. But the biggest flaw that people have been talking about is that around 2025, when the treaty expires in different stages, the Iranians are free, absolutely free, to assemble their nuclear stockpile of weapons. In other words, say the critics, perhaps in around 2025, when many of the provisions of the treaty expire, the Iranians will be, quote, one screw turn away from assembling a nuclear missile. So in other words, yes, for the coming years, they will freeze their nuclear stockpile. But once the treaty expires, once they have rebuilt their economy, once they become once again a superpower in the Middle East, they'll be literally weeks away from having a nuclear arsenal, and there is nothing, nothing that the Europeans or the United States can do about it because it would all be legal. Because the treaty says nothing, absolutely nothing about freezing the stockpile after the treaty ends. So some people say that, well, the treaty is going to be good for the next several years until around 2025. But then all hell could break loose because Iran will be a nuclear superpower in the Middle East. And then the critics of the treaty say, look at the politics of the situation. We have this grand split in the Middle East between the Shiites and the Sunnis. Now, the Sunnis have been in power for most of that period of time in the Middle East, but because of the rise of Iran, we now have a potential civil war within the Islamic world. First of all, there was a stalemate between the Shiites and the Sunnis because Iraq would represent the Sunni powers, while Iran represented the Shiites. But you see, because of the war in the Middle East pushed by President George W. Bush, the Iraqi government basically collapsed. And as a consequence, there was no more stalemate between the Shiites and the Sunnis with the fall of Saddam Hussein, which meant that Iranian power has vastly increased in power along with the Shiites. That's why they're backing Syria. The Syrian government is not Sunni at all. The Syrian government is Shiite, a branch of the Shiite religion, and that's why the Iranians are, in a sectarian way, cynically backing the Syrians, not because they're against violence, but because they want to back another Shiite regime. And the same thing is happening throughout the Middle East, where Shiite rebels are being backed by the Iranians. And that's why the Saudis, who are backers of the Sunni faction, that's why the Saudis were furious that President Barack Obama basically handed the atomic bomb to the Iranians after 2025. And that's why the Saudis have said that they too will pursue a nuclear arsenal if the Iranians start to pursue their nuclear ambitions as well. In other words, what a mess. Then the question is, what next? What's going to be the next step now that the United States has pulled out of the agreement with Iran? Well, in the short term, nothing. The great powers still have several weeks to months to work out the details of pulling out of the agreement. So far, the Europeans and the Iranians have said that they will abide. They will abide by what's left of the nuclear agreement with Iran. But sooner or later, decisions will have to be made if the United States is going to reimpose sanctions on Iran, and if the United States refuses to deal with countries which maintain cordial relations with Iran. Because the United States, from a European point of view, is a 900-pound gorilla, it means, well, if this gorilla leaves the room, then the Europeans are going to have to ask a simple question. Which way are they going to go? Are they going to go with the United States, which is most likely, or are they going to go with the Iranians? So in the short term, the Iranians are saying that they're keeping their fingers crossed. They're saying they're going to stay within the agreement. However, there's another scenario. This other scenario is that maybe the great powers will renegotiate a new nuclear deal, not to freeze the arsenal of the Iranians, but to denuclearize the Middle East. That, of course, would be a maximum scenario, not just of freezing a nuclear arsenal, which can be reinvigorated after 2025, but to actually denuclearize the Middle East. Now, of course, Israel most likely has an arsenal of nuclear weapons. It would probably mean that there has to be some kind of grand denuclearization gesture whereby the Israelis also have to denuclearize their nuclear arsenal. Well, we don't know which way it would go, but a new treaty might be perhaps the best way to resolve the crisis. First, it would take care of the ballistic missiles that Iran keeps on testing. Any new agreement would have to rein in Iran's nuclear ballistic missile program. And second of all, it would have to end not just a freeze, it would have to incorporate not just a freeze, but a nuclear denuclearization of the Middle East. Otherwise, in 2025, we're going to be facing a nuclear-armed Iran that has a modern economy that is a superpower in the Middle East. So we hope that the details can be worked out. But one good scenario that many people believe might happen is a renegotiation of the agreement so that we rein in the ballistic missiles of Iran and so that it's not just a freeze, which can be unfrozen on a moment's notice after 2025, but a denuclearization of the Middle East. And speaking about denuclearization, things are changing in the Korean Peninsula as well. Just a few months ago, President Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un were exchanging insults, and pushing the world closer and closer to the brink of a nuclear confrontation. Well, just when it seemed as if war was going to be imminent, people began to back off. The North Koreans blinked, and they have stated that, well, they are open to negotiations on new terms. The new terms are that the United States would have to pledge not to invade North Korea, and in exchange for a pledge of some sort like that, the North Koreans would denuclearize, not just freeze a nuclear arsenal of perhaps 20 to 60 atomic bombs, but actually engage in the process of denuclearizing, and in fact, denuclearizing the entire Korean Peninsula. Now, this has pluses and minuses. First of all, as the New York Times pointed out, even if the North Koreans wanted to denuclearize, verifying it would be very difficult. Much of the Korean nuclear arsenal is underground in very secure facilities and is spread out over North Korea, making it very difficult to verify an agreement. Second of all, we have to realize that, well, time is not necessarily in favor of the North Koreans, because it turns out that the North Korean test facility perhaps collapsed. It turns out that the North Koreans have been testing the nuclear weapons in the middle of a mountaintop, but it turns out that that mountaintop, at least by satellite projections, has collapsed. Collapsed, meaning that at the present time, they have no means to test nuclear weapons underground. And so time, in that sense, is not on the side of the North Koreans. They're going to have to create another new mountaintop to test their nuclear weapons. So one problem is to verify a nuclear freeze and denuclearization, given the fact that the North Korean program is highly dispersed underground and it's quite secretive. But the North Koreans have another incentive to want to come to the bargaining table, and that is the sanctions apparently are beginning to hurt. Now, the previous sanctions that were lodged against the North Koreans, we now know, did not do that much at all. 90% of the resources flowing into North Korea come from China. And only recently have the Chinese indicated in a very feeble way that they are willing to put restrictions on energy supplies to North Korea. So the North Koreans are in a bind. On one hand, they realize that the Chinese patience with North Korea is wearing thin, even though the North Koreans are still getting supplies from China. Also, we have the collapse of their nuclear test site. And we also have the possibility that Donald Trump is open to some kind of grand agreement. He thinks of himself as the great negotiators. And one thing that great negotiators love is to fool everybody by pulling some kind of rabbit out of the hat. Well, of course, the North Koreans also want some stipulations on their side. They want to guarantee that the United States is no longer going to conduct nuclear exercises off its coast. Now, with some justification, the North Koreans have a point saying that the military exercises that are conducted with U.S. nuclear forces and South Korea is a pretext for a full-scale invasion. So they see that if the United States were willing to call off these exercises, it means that an invasion would be much less likely, and therefore that would bring the North Koreans to the bargaining table if there could be some kind of grand agreement that the United States will not invade North Korea. Well, you have to realize that the North Koreans have some bad examples to look at. Look at what happened to Saddam Hussein, and look what happened to Gaddafi. They're not here anymore. They are, in fact, executed. In fact, their own people turned against them. Now, in all fairness, we should say that it was not as if the United States simply toppled Saddam Hussein and toppled Gaddafi. No, it was much more complicated than that. However, the North Koreans are saying that, well, nuclear weapons were one of the main reasons why those governments were stable. However, they're not stable because, of course, nuclear weapons did not guarantee stability in Iraq or in Libya. So what's going to happen? Well, the short answer is we don't know. But any time the great powers decide to meet and negotiate, I think, is a good thing. Even if they simply beat their chest and try to get lots of propaganda points, the very fact that they're talking to each other, I think, is a good step in the right direction. And the very fact that the word denuclearization, not freeze, but denuclearization is on the table, I think, is a very good indication that, well, perhaps a deal can be cut. And now let me ask you a question about this universe of ours. What is the relationship? What is the relationship between medieval texts, texts dating back over 1,000 years ago, and the search for a new planet in the solar system far beyond the orbit of Neptune? Well, at first you may say to yourself, nothing. I mean, back then, during the Middle Ages, they didn't even have telescopes. No telescope. So how could they possibly say anything about the possibility of a new planet in the solar system? Well, it turns out that there is a relationship. First of all, how many planets are there in the solar system? When I was growing up, it was taught that there are 9 planets, from Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, all the way up to Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. Well, then Pluto was unceremoniously dropped from the solar system, and the solar system then was deemed to have 8 planets. But now scientists at Caltech in Pasadena, California, are saying that there could be a 9th planet, not Pluto, but a mysterious planet way out there in outer space, perhaps 20 times the distance from Neptune. And it means that it could be a giant planet, perhaps 10 times the mass of the Earth. Now, how do we know this? First of all, there's absolutely no telescopic evidence of a 9th planet. Let me repeat that. There's no evidence whatsoever using our telescopes that there is a 9th planet beyond the orbit of Neptune. So why are the astronomers at Caltech talking about a 9th planet? Because if you take a look at the trajectory of objects like comets way out there in what is called the Kuiper Belt, you find that their orbits are a little bit irregular. They're wobbling just a little bit, meaning that something is tugging on them. And if you run it through a computer program, bingo, you find out that there must be an object quite large, 10 times the mass of the Earth, way out there, 20 times the distance of Neptune, that is disturbing the motion of these Kuiper Belt objects. Now, in the past, the wobbling of planets have indicated the presence of another planet. Take a look, for example, at the ancients. The ancients believed that there were planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, and that's where it ended. There are no planets, according to the ancients, beyond that of Saturn. However, then astronomers found the orbit of Uranus, but they noticed that Uranus wobbled a little bit. Now, either Isaac Newton was wrong in terms of mapping out the motion of planets, either Isaac Newton was wrong, which was a conclusion that astronomers did not want to believe, or there was a new planet out there tugging gravitationally on the orbit of Uranus. Well, using mathematics, people could predict where this mysterious planet was, and bingo, within just a few hours of turning on their telescopes, astronomers were able to find the planet Neptune. Now it turns out that the orbits even farther out from Neptune are wobbling slightly, and it means that perhaps there is a 9th planet that is tugging on Neptune and the Kuiper Belt objects. Well, it turns out now that some people who are medieval experts realize that we have a treasure trove of sightings of comets and the precise trajectory. Now, of course, back then they didn't have telescopes. However, using eyesight and taking very meticulous notes, we can then recreate the motion of ancient planets that whizzed through our solar system 1,000 years ago. And that's what astronomers are looking at now. They suddenly realize that there's a treasure trove of astronomical information once thought to be useless that details the precise motion of comets in the sky. Now, comets come from way out there in outer space, from the Kuiper Belt of comets and the Oort cloud of comets, and their trajectories would be sensitive to the presence of a 9th planet. And that's the relationship between medieval humanists and modern astronomers of today, that perhaps we will have yet another way to prove the existence of a 9th planet, which has not yet been observed using telescopes because it is so far away, and we don't know the precise location of this 9th planet. However, we also have to realize that there could be some surprises. For example, many astronomers decades ago thought there was a planet inside the orbit of Mercury. You see, Mercury also wobbles, so either Isaac Newton was wrong, or perhaps there is a planet closer to the sun than Mercury that tugs on it and makes it wobble. Well, that's why astronomers believe in the planet called Vulcan. It was a hypothetical planet closer to the sun than Mercury, but every time people looked for Vulcan, they found nothing. So the other conclusion was Isaac Newton was wrong. And who proved that? Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein came out with a new theory in 1915 called general relativity, which showed that space itself could be curved slightly, giving a trajectory of Mercury which wobbled. And when Einstein calculated the amount of wobbling of Mercury, bingo, it came out just as expected. So we know that, yes, it is possible that Isaac Newton's laws of gravity are wrong. In this case, the planet Vulcan does not exist. We have instead Einstein's theory of general relativity. But now we have this other mystery, a ninth planet that has not been observed by telescopes, but may actually exist using the data from the wobbling of Kuiper Belt comets. Now, some people believe that there's a 10th planet out there called Nibiru, a planet which periodically can disturb the orbit of the Earth and perhaps even create doomsday. However, let me be very clear about this. Scientists have looked for this so-called 10th planet and find nothing. So don't get your hopes up and don't get alarmed. As far as we can tell, there is no 10th planet out there called Nibiru, which could initiate doomsday. And also, we have some news on the medical front. Many people think that diabetes is going to be one of the major illnesses of the 21st century. First of all, people don't watch their diet very well. Not only do we have type 1 diabetes that you get at birth, we also have an epidemic in type 2 diabetes, adult onset diabetes, partially spurred by the fact that people eat too many sweets and don't watch their diet very well. Well, the consequences of diabetes could be horrendous. Diabetes attacks, for example, the small capillaries and blood vessels of the human body, especially those found in our limbs and also in our eyes, leading to the potential amputation of our limbs and blindness. Well, diabetes is caused by the fact that our pancreas does not regulate the amount of insulin in the body very well. There are little isles of Langerhans on the pancreas which secrete insulin. Now it turns out, however, that scientists have been able to use stem cell technology to create what appears to be artificial isles of Langerhans that may stimulate the production of insulin. However, let's be fair about this. And so far, we're talking about breakthroughs in mice, not in humans. Well, that ends the first part of exploration. Talking about nuclear weapons now, in the second half of exploration, once again, we're going to bring on two military officials who are in charge of our nuclear arsenal who know about the secret history of nuclear accidents. So once again, in the second half of exploration, we'll talk about Broken Arrows, the secret history of nuclear weapons accidents, the price we pay for having a nuclear arsenal. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we summarized some of the top stories of the past, including the fact that there seems to be a breakthrough in the Korean negotiations between Kim Jong-un and President Donald Trump, as well as the fact that the president has basically rejected the Iran nuclear agreement that was negotiated by President Barack Obama, that was in some sense his signature achievement. So in the second half of Exploration, talking about nuclear weapons, we'll talk about the hidden cost of nuclear weapons, and that is the possibility of nuclear accidents. We know, for example, that in North Korea, even though they successfully tested nuclear weapons inside a mountain, well, apparently the mountain collapsed. There are reports showing that the roof of this underground facility collapsed, which could be one reason that is prodding the North Koreans to perhaps say that they don't need nuclear weapons if they can get some kind of guarantee that the United States will not invade North Korea. So in the second half of Exploration, we're going to talk about broken arrows, the long history of nuclear accidents, both in the Soviet Union and in the United States. We know about nuclear accidents in the United States involving nuclear weapons that have been dropped on Georgia and South Carolina, but there's also a secret history that we're going to talk about in today's show, not to mention the fact that the Soviets have had their share of secret nuclear accidents as well. Michael Machelet and James Oskins are two retired members of the military, and believe it or not, they were in charge of handling nuclear weapons, that is, atomic and hydrogen bombs capable of wiping out New York City or Los Angeles. Weapons of incredible power. And did you know that they've actually fell out of bomb bays of jets, actually landed on people's backyards in South Carolina? And did you know that they were actually snagged by a tree in North Carolina and almost were set off? Did you know that you can actually reclaim a nuclear weapon on your own? Because a nuclear weapon was dropped off the coast of Georgia. It's still there. No one yet has been able to reclaim that nuclear weapon. And did you know that we dropped several hydrogen bombs off the coast of Spain near a tourist town? It caused a mass panic and evacuation of that tourist town. And submarines had to be sent down to grab one hydrogen bomb that landed intact in the Mediterranean. The submarine Alvin, in fact, was sent down to grab that hydrogen bomb. It reached out, grabbed the hydrogen bomb, and missed. And the hydrogen bomb then tumbled on the floor of the Atlantic Ocean till it finally came to rest. Did you know there's an entire secret history of our handling of nuclear weapons? Listening to Michael Machelet and James Oskins, you would think that Butterfingers are operating our nuclear weapons arsenal. Well, to be fair, the U.S. military operates tens of thousands of nuclear weapons, especially at the height of the Cold War, and the Russians did too. They had their share of nuclear weapons accidents. In fact, some of their nuclear weapons accidents were even greater than the nuclear accidents that we suffered here in the United States. Now, fortunately, none of these weapons detonated. However, we came very close to an accidental detonation in North Carolina. Goldsboro, North Carolina, was almost wiped out the face of the earth when a hydrogen bomb was snagged by a tree as it fell out of the bomb bay of a jet, landed on a tree, snagged by its parachute, and luckily the safeties did not go off. Otherwise, literally, we would have lost Goldsboro, North Carolina. So listen to the secret history of nuclear weapons. And let's hope and pray that none of our nuclear weapons accidentally goes off. The first question for you, Mike, is how did you get interested in the whole concept of nuclear weapons accidents?
Well, I was a nuclear weapons specialist in the Air Force from 1980 to 1995, and I retired in 1995. And During most of my time in service, I had a big interest in the history of our career field. And after I got out, I decided I was going to create a web page and research some of the history. And in the process, I learned, of course, you know, a lot of the stuff wasn't public, and we had to do a lot of digging. And in the course of my research, we discovered that there were three Air Force specialty codes in the nuclear weapons career field. There was mechanical assembly, there was electronics, and there was nuclear components. And Jim happened to be a person who worked on the nuclear components, and he knew a chief master sergeant that I knew overseas. So from that point on, we're doing research for our website. We decided, well, why don't we write a book about Broken Arrows? Because we knew there's a lot of information coming into the public domain. And from that point on, we spent several years gathering information, requesting information, and the end result, of course, is our book, Broken Arrow, the Classified History of U.S. Nuclear Weapons Accidents.
Okay, and Jim, precisely how did you obtain this information?
Through a lot of correspondence with different government agencies. The information is not held by a single agency, unfortunately. We've contacted the Defense Threat Reduction Agency, the National Nuclear Security Administration, Department of Energy, Air Force Safety Command, Air Force Historical Research Agency, the National Archives, Department of Energy Nevada, U.S. Navy, U.S. Air Force, U.S. Army. A lot of correspondence and a lot of patience.
Okay, now let's get right into the whole concept of Broken Arrow. Some of these incidences have, in fact, gone into the public domain, but in a very sketchy way. You guys have compiled the largest and most complete set of information concerning these incidences. However, when I spoke in South Carolina once, people gave me some news clippings of what happens in 1958. It was Mars Bluff, Florence, South Carolina. A B-47 bomber dropped an atomic bomb on the Gregg family. The Gregg family heard this explosion. They went outside. The woodshed was blown apart. And later, the military came in and paid them off to keep their mouths shut about that incident, and of course to pay for some of the damage. And they also came in to bulldoze some of the soil. However, you got the goods. I just have some newspaper clippings. What actually happened in 1958 in Florence, South Carolina? Mike.
There was a B-47 aircraft that was flying at approximately 35,000 to 40,000 feet. And what apparently happened is one of the crew members, the aircraft was either carrying a Mark 6 bomb or we believe a Mark 36 bomb.
And how does that compare with the Hiroshima bomb, by the way?
It was the Mark 6 basically was an improved Fat Man bomb.
Like the Nagasaki bomb.
Yes, a large implosion weapon. Basically an improved version of the Fat Man and the Mark IV. Or it could have been a Mark 36 early thermonuclear weapon, which required, of course, a capsule of nuclear weapons material. And during that time frame, of course, they kept the capsule separate in the crew compartment. We know that there was an inadvertent release, as they put it in the documentation. And, of course, the weapon dropped and impacted with the ground. And, when, of course, that happens, you have about 5,000 pounds of high explosive.
Now, it was the conventional explosive that detonated, right? We should make that clear. There's been no accidental nuclear detonation ever, but this was the conventional explosive that detonated.
Right. The early fission weapons and the early thermonuclear bombs had what was called a capsule, and this is kept separate until immediately before strike or... either a crew member had to go in and manually insert the nuclear material in the case of the Mark VI, or in the case of, say, later early thermonuclear types, it was already installed, but there's an electromechanical mechanism, a screwjack mechanism, to put it in that the bomb commander could, you know, just flick a switch. And, of course, now you mentioned, of course, the apparent lack of radiation. It is pretty interesting. Because those early bombs do contain a quantity of natural uranium in the tamper. So Yeah, there probably was some radioactive, real slight radioactive contamination, but the problem, I think, is it was in a swampy area. And in the case of, you mentioned Thule, when you have, like, water and, you know, residual contaminants around, the survey instruments don't pick this material up.
Okay. And, Jim, tell us a little bit about the cleanup operation. What happens when you drop an atomic bomb on someone's backyard and you have to go in and clean up the mess? Exactly what happens?
Well, it depends on the weapon. In that case, as Mike mentioned, there probably would be some residual radioactivity from the tamper, but the tamper was composed of what we now call depleted uranium, which actually is a very low-level radioactive element. In my career, actually, I worked on a lot of that. It's not very hazardous unless you ingest it. As far as cleanup goes, there's not much to it. The high explosive was more or less fragmented that. Just leaving it on the surface, basically, to be scooped up.
Now, it was mentioned that the bomb might have been an improved Nagasaki bomb. The Nagasaki bomb was a plutonium bomb. Plutonium is the most toxic chemical known to science. So is it conceivable that plutonium rather than uranium was released in that incident in 1958 in South Carolina?
No.
And
how's
that?
Plutonium would have been contained in the capsule.
Mm-hmm.
And the capsule was not inserted. The capsule was not on board the aircraft at the time.
Uh-huh. So it was not fully loaded then when the bomb was dropped?
No, it was not.
So there was no danger of a real detonation taking place, but it was
No.
a broken arrow.
No, there was not.
I see. Okay. Now let's move on. You'd think that the military would have learned its lesson, dropping atomic bombs on people's backyards. Let's now talk about Goldsboro, North Carolina, where several hydrogen bombs apparently were dropped, according to the press reports. According to the press reports, every hydrogen bomb has safeties on them, four or five safeties, and all but one of the safeties on one of the hydrogen bombs was set off when its parachute was snagged on a tree, causing a jolt, and the jolt almost accidentally set off that hydrogen bomb, according to press reports. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara indirectly referred to that incident, stating in public that there was one incident where we came very close to an accidental detonation of a nuclear weapon on the United States. Now, these are, of course, published reports. Tell us now what actually happened. Mike?
Well, the aircraft was flying an airborne alert mission. It was a B-52, and I believe that one was a breakup in midair. And what happened was the aircraft, the weapons, the Mark 39 weapons inside the aircraft were locked in the U-2 locking mechanism. Basically, it was like a bicycle chain that wrapped around the weapon and held the weapon in the bomb bay. It was a rather primitive system, but I guess it worked under the circumstances. The aircraft broke up in flight, and in the process of it, you know, catching fire and breaking up and spinning out of control, the weapons were torn free from the bomb bay. And in the process, of course, the bomb rack separated from the shackle, and the weapon, and of course, it pulled the arming rod. Now, there's no electrical power applied to the weapon, but in the early days, in the early weapons, once you pulled, say, an arming rod, it activated a low-voltage thermal battery. And that started the chain of events. One of the weapons, of course, fell with a parachute, which is, I guess, pretty fortunate because it was recovered intact. And that's the weapon that's lit. Of course, they recovered with the parachute that's in the famous picture. Now, the other weapon fell free fall, and there's a number of the mechanisms that, of course, were activated. Of course, as we mentioned, the arming wires were pulled. A pulse generator was activated. There's a number of other components, explosive actuators. There were timers, safety timers that have to run before other components are armed or activated. For example, example, there's barrel switches, there's inertial switches, high voltage thermal battery. And the final steps, of course, to detonate a weapon is, of course, you have to, what we call the X unit or the fire set has to be armed. And, of course, there's other components that are required to fire a nuclear weapon. For example, there's what's called a tritium reservoir. It contains a tritium deuterium gas, which is injected into the hollow pit of the weapon before it actually detonates. So there are still a number of steps that had to the weapon had to go through before it was could detonate in the nuclear sense. We mentioned the free fall weapon. That weapon fell to Earth and it actually penetrated into the ground. It was basically, of course, destroyed a telescope within itself, and the secondary actually separated. In that case, the secondary, they estimate, probably went down about another 75 feet or so. They excavated the area. During the excavation, they actually recovered some of these components, and in the course of doing so, they recovered the arming switch, and it was destroyed when it hit the Earth, but they thought at first that the arming switch had armed. Now, of course, that would be a great matter of concern, and Jim and I have gone through the reports, and we determined that there is actually another arming switch that had to be activated before final arming and firing. That was called the trajectory arming switch, and they actually in documentation, they actually noted that there is probably a need for a trajectory arming switch for nuclear safety.
Okay.
But, you did mention that there was a lot of concern, and it was a serious incident. That's that can't be denied. I mean, it was a wake-up call as far as nuclear safety went.
Okay. So, Jim, now, could you summarize for us safeties? How many safeties, like a safety on a gun, how many safeties are there on a hydrogen bomb that you have to activate in order for the thing to detonate? And in this incident, exactly how close did we come to setting off all these safeties?
It depends actually on the weapon and when it was manufactured, the age and the development of the technology. There's probably on that Mark 39, I believe there were 7 safeties.
Mm-hmm.
2 of which did not arm. So there actually was little possibility that it would have detonated nuclearly.
So in other words, there were about 7 safeties. 5 of them were set off, but 2 of them held, and that prevented any possibility of an accidental detonation. Is that right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it functioned as designed.
Uh-huh. And what did the military learn after that? This is probably the closest we've ever come, right, to an actual detonation?
That we know of, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now let's move on to 1966. This time we're going to go to Spain in an incident that was widely reported in the European press. This time 4 hydrogen bombs fell out of the bomb bay when there was a KC-135 refueling tanker that collided with the military weapon. 4 hydrogen bombs fell out. 3 landed on this tourist town, and 1 landed in the Mediterranean. And it caused mass panic, mass evacuation, widespread coverage in the European press because there was a live hydrogen warhead sitting in the Mediterranean. And according to press reports, the military then sent the Alvin submarine, which is very famous because the Alvin submarine also went down to the Titanic and took those incredible pictures of the Titanic. The Alvin submarine reached out, located the 4th hydrogen bomb, reached out with its grappling hooks, grabbed the weapon, and missed. As a consequence, the bomb tumbled further into the Mediterranean, causing even more panic in this tourist town. Meanwhile, the military came in with trucks and began to cart off all the radioactive materials. One bomb had completely broken open and released its plutonium. Now, these are the press reports. Tell us now what actually happened. Mike.
Well, I guess the press is pretty much spot on when they're discussing, the incident in general. But, of course, we have the classified documentation that discusses basically the what happened to every single individual weapon. For example, you mentioned that, of course, the one weapon that fell into the Mediterranean, and of course, that was recovered after, I think, 2 months or more. That's interesting because I read a post-mortem report on that, and even at that depth, the seawater did manage to penetrate all into the weapon components and soak the high explosives and everything. So basically, the weapon, you know, couldn't have detonated. It was basically inerted in a you know, an explosive sense. The other weapons, of course, two weapons did land on the Spanish soil, and there was some plutonium contamination, and it was, of course, a very serious accident. We have reports of that that we're going to put in our next book. Basically, of course, we're going to expand on a lot of the accidents and introduce some new accidents. But yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff. I guess we can discuss on Palomares. In fact, one of my friends up in Montana was actually involved in that accident. He was flying he was the pilot of a KC-135, and he got a message to switch lead aircraft during the refueling. So that's a rather strange incident there.
And, Jim, could you elaborate on the cleanup operation? According to press reports, of course, widely covered in the European press. In fact, there's even a book about the Palomares incident. Many trucks had to come in to cart off large quantities of radioactive soil. Any comments?
Yes, that's true. There was a lot of, since two weapons detonated on impact with the soil, the high explosive in them detonated. Those weapons did contain a measure of plutonium, which, of course, is more hazardous than depleted uranium. And that's basically what they were cleaning up. I believe there were some tomato patches that were involved, a lot of people. Basically, the material was, topsoil was scooped off, put into containers, and sent back to the States. And buried.
And as I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, that fourth hydrogen bomb that fell into the Mediterranean that was reclaimed by the Alvin submarine is on display. In fact, I visited it. It's in the Albuquerque Atomic Museum. And as I understand, it has a dent in the front part of the bomb when the bomb impacted. And I believe it's on the cover of your book. Is that true?
Yes, it is. Yeah. The dent actually is in the material. It's a honeycomb material that's designed to absorb impact. And there's no bomb components actually involved in that area of the weapon.
Mm-hmm.
It was simply honeycomb material that collapsed.
Okay, now let's move on. We talked about South Carolina, North Carolina, Palomares, and now let's talk about Greenland, just 2 years after the famous Palomares incident. This time we dropped atomic bombs on the ice in Thule, Greenland, and had to send in Huskies and other kinds of elaborate equipment to reclaim radioactive ice. Well, that's according to the press reports. Tell us now, Mike, what really happened in 1968 in Greenland.
Well, we had a B-52 from Plattsburgh Air Force Base, which I used to be stationed at, but of course not during that time frame. It was flying an airborne alert mission, and they had a fire in the cockpit, and they couldn't put the fire out. And they decided to head for Thule and hopefully make an emergency landing. Well, the situation degraded very quickly, and smoke was in the cockpit. The crew flew over the base. They actually flew over the base and ejected, and the aircraft kept flying for a little bit, and it started a turn. And approximately 7 miles from the base on the sea ice, the aircraft impacted. And we found some documents that indicate that the aircraft probably hit the sea ice at going over 600 knots, which I believe is approximately about 660 miles an hour. And in that case, in the weapons it was carrying four thermonuclear weapons in what we call a clip-in. And at that speed, there's no chance at all that any weapon could survive an impact with a high explosive. Now, we do know from reading the documentation that I'd say with 100% reliability, all four weapons were destroyed. We know that from reading the documentation that they recovered four tritium reservoirs almost 2 miles from the point of impact. And like I mentioned before, you had that aircraft come in at that speed, bam, hit the sea ice, say at the, I don't know the down angle it was, but we know it was coming down pretty quick and at a steep angle. And we all know the force and physics involved when you hit something, you know, like you throw a football or a basketball on the ground, it's going to ricochet off. And that's exactly what those bomb components did. Now, there was some concern, of course, about maybe a weapon that maybe sunk through the ice or weapons. They actually released that in some press releases. And, of course, given their experience in Spain, I don't think that would have presented a problem recovering any weapons that were under the sea ice at the time, because the depth of Volstenholme Bay was approximately 800 feet. But we do know, of course, we've actually reviewed all the message traffic that they declassified several years ago. It's about 300 pages, and they list all the components. We've actually got to have a chart in our new book that's going to list all the weapon components. It's all unclassified. So we can say with 100% surety that all four bombs were, in fact, destroyed. So there's no missing nuclear weapon in Thule.
Okay, Jim, any more comments about this mess in Thule, Greenland? I'm sure the Greenland government wasn't too happy about the fact that they had all this radioactive ice. But any comments?
The key comment is, I think, the fact that even though the four weapons sustained a huge impact, they did not detonate nuclearly. There was no nuclear detonation. They were actually in a safe condition when the aircraft crashed. And the radioactivity was spread based on the detonation of the explosive in the weapon. And it did take quite a while to clean it up. I mean, they were working in conditions of minus 50 degrees in the dark.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku. Our special guests today were James Hoskins and Michael Magillet, author of the disturbing book Broken Arrow, about the secret history of nuclear weapons accidents. Even during peacetime, even when there's not a nuclear war, we have to worry about the fact that of the tens of thousands of weapons we have, some of them may land on somebody's backyard. And if you want to have a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. That's 1-800-735-0230. Good day.